The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
This week's portion is a double portion, Bahar B'chukotai, and there are a couple of issues that are such life lessons that it's worth taking a moment. You know, one of the challenges, I think, in life is how to, on the one hand, be sure that you're moving towards some, you know, general destination, you know, that you've got goals in mind and you feel you're progressing because, you know, you're never standing still. You're either moving forwards or you're moving backwards on the one hand. On the other hand, sometimes there's a need to be able to sort of slow down, to kind of stop the ride. And the question is what that's all about. So this week's portion, really double portion, and these two portions are very, very often linked together, have such disparate topics that it's almost as though the Torah is forcing us to consider the relationship between these topics. The first portion, the portion of Bahar, which is in Vayikra, this Leviticus, we're actually going to conclude the middle book of the Torah, the book of Vayikra, this week, right? The first portion starts with a mitzvah that actually most Jews, at least certainly those outside of Israel, and even many inside of Israel, have completely lost touch with. And that is the sabbatical year. Okay? Once every seventh year, right? And this mitzvah only applies in Israel. You're covered on this one out of Israel. Every seventh year, the mitzvah, the obligation, was to let the land lie fallow. Now, for a culture that was agricultural, that was no small challenge. And even though you could pick things from the field, you didn't plant, and you didn't harvest sort of for the harvest, as opposed to just picking some fruit off the trees. The entire field, the crops, everything was called hefker. It was free for anyone to come and take, right? And there are all sorts of promises in the Torah that, you know, if the Jewish people will indeed let the land lie fallow the seventh year, that God will bless us in the sixth year and the eighth year, which is an amazing thing. In the sixth year, Hashem already knows whether we're going to live up to this challenge in the seventh year, and we'll get enough of a bounty in the sixth year, right? But more than that, we'll get a bounty in the eighth year, right? We don't have to worry about the crops for 1 year, okay? And the verses here, the whole beginning of Parshat Bahar, is all about v'shavta haaretz, and the land should rest. Shabbat Lashem, it's a Shabbat, to, you know, a sabbatical year for God. Shabbat Shabbaton, it's a super Shabbat, right? V'hayta Shabbat haaretz lachem, this will be the sort of the resting of the land for you, right? So that's the beginning of this double portion. But after that, we get to the second portion, which is B'chukotai. And B'chukotai is one of the most difficult portions in the entire Torah. It contains, and it's one of two places where we find this, it contains what's known as the tochacha, literally the critique, the curses, the klalot, right? And it's a description of what will happen to the Jewish people in the event that we do the right thing and in the event we do the wrong thing. And it begins very well, right? If you look in Leviticus, in the beginning of the parasha, v'im b'chukotai t'lechu, if you will sort of walk in my statutes, v'et mitzvotai t'shmoru, and guard or cherish my commandments, v'asitam otam, and you'll do them, then I'll give you rain on time, and the land will produce its bounty, and there'll be good harvests, and there won't be any wild animals, and cherev lo tavo ba'atzachem, there'll be no war in your land, etc., etc. But, continues the Torah, if in fact, im lo tishmuli, v'lo tasut kol mitzvot ha'ela, and you don't do all of these mitzvot, right, etc., etc., then you're going to be in big trouble. And you will experience exile, and pestilence, and disaster, and some of the most painful, difficult, challenging verses in the entire Torah, right? The curses that will befall the Jewish people. And you could very much make a case for saying that we experience this, right? That we experience these types of curses, certainly in the Holocaust, right? You can find every single one of the verses that describes the pain that the Jewish people will go through in the Holocaust, in the Crusades, in Khmelnytsky's massacres, right? Very, very difficult verses. And you have to wonder, what causes, Right? First of all, what is the connection between the sabbatical year, the fact that you're supposed to let the land lie fallow for a year on the one hand, which is an important mitzvah, but it's certainly not sort of up there in the top 10 list of mitzvot. It's not included in the Ten Commandments, at least ostensibly, right? It's not something most Jews think about. So what's the connection between that agricultural mitzvah and the idea that if we don't follow Hashem's commandments, that we could be exiled and suffer tremendously, etc.? By the way, just to make a sidebar point, no one should walk away from this discussion assuming that what I'm suggesting is that any particular event, the Holocaust or whatever, occurred because Jews or a specific group of Jews didn't follow or adhere to a specific group of commandments, right? First of all, I don't think that that's our job in this world to figure out, right? To make it that specific. Second of all, there were plenty of generations that struggled with the same issues and the same mitzvot and did not experience the Holocaust. And by the way, since. So I don't think it's a very dangerous thing for people to point fingers like that. However, as a generality, the Torah definitely tells us that if we don't do what we're meant to be doing, then we don't deserve to be in the land of Israel and we're going to experience tremendous pain. Okay. What does that have to do with the sabbatical year? And even more interesting, what is it, if you get down to the root of it, what is it that causes such painful, difficult klalot, right? Such difficult curses. Now, if you look in the beginning of the second portion, Bechukotai, okay? So the verse says, Im Bechukotai Telechu, which you could translate, if you will walk in my statutes or follow my decrees, V'et mitzvotai tishmaru, and you will keep or guard my commandments, okay? This presents somewhat of a difficult challenge because we have to understand if this is the linchpin on which everything is based, then what exactly is it that everything is dependent on? First of all, what does im b'chukotai telechu mean if you will follow or walk in my statutes? Rashi here points out that it can't mean that the Torah is saying if you fulfill the mitzvot. Because that's the very next part of the verse, right? It says, "Im b'chukotai tilechu, if you will follow my statutes, ve'et mitzvotai tishmoru, and you will guard or cherish my commandments." So, et mitzvotai tishmoru, or tishmoru, that you will guard or cherish my commandments, that's the general fulfillment of mitzvot. Which leaves us wondering, in this verse, which by the way is chapter 26, verse 3, right? Perek Chavav Pasuk Gimel, the beginning of the portion of Bechukotai. What exactly does im Bechukotai Telechu mean? What does it mean if you will walk in my commandments? In fact, Rashi says, Yachol Zek Kiyuma Mitzvot. You could think that this is just the general fulfillment of Mitzvot. Kasheu Omer Vet Mitzvotai Tishmoru. But it says it, Mitzvotai Tishmoru, and you shall, you know, keep the commandments. Hare Kiyuma Mitzvot Amur. So then what does im b'chukotai telechu mean? Shetiyu amelim b'torah. That you should toil in Torah. To toil in Torah. Which seems to mean Torah study. And in fact, on the next verse, v'et mitzvotai tishmor, Rashi continues, hevu amelim b'torah al menat lishmor l'kayim. Toil in Torah, study Torah, in order to be able to fulfill the commandments, right? If you don't study what tefillin are, you're not going to be able to put them on because you won't know how to do it. If you don't study the laws of Shabbat, you'll have a hard time fulfilling Shabbat. If you don't, in a detailed fashion, study the laws of gossip and slander, you won't know how many transgressions you can violate with a single sentence. So you have to study Torah, right? K'moshe ne'emar, and then Rashi goes on. So that's a difficult question. All of this pain, all of this tragedy, that we'll be mad from what we see, that pestilence will strike us, that the land will be destroyed, that the people will be exiled, that our children will be sold as slaves, all this because we're not amelim b'torah, because we don't toil in Torah. By the way, it doesn't say that you don't live a Torah life, it just says you don't toil in it. Now my vision of toiling in Torah, okay, is when I was in yeshiva, and there were guys who would sit up, and I was in awe of these guys. They would wake up at 5:30 in the morning, and I remember for a certain period of time in my life, you have no family, you have no job, you're studying, you can throw yourself into this, and you wake up at 4:30 in the morning to pray with the sunrise, and you're basically studying all day, finally falling into sleep at like 1:30 in the morning, only to wake up again 3 hours later, and of course on Shabbat you crash in the afternoon. That's toiling in Torah. You know? In fact, in certain ways, studying in yeshiva was much more difficult than the army. Because the army is physical. Physical you can do. But to be able to sit on a bench for 6, 7, 8 hours straight and just pour through a text, that takes a certain amount of willpower. And that's to be a male, to toil in Torah. So don't get me wrong, that's a beautiful thing. But the average Jew today doesn't toil in Torah. So because we're not toiling in Torah, all of this calamity will befall the Jewish people. That's a very strange thing. And what's really strange about it is, it's not entirely accurate. Because if you look further in chapter 26, in verse 34, in Pasuk Lamed Daled, the verses of the Torah imply something different. What does the verse imply? The verse says, in Pasuk Lamed Dimel, Ve'etchem ezareh v'goyim, and I will spread you, scatter you amongst the nations, right? Ve'arikoti achechem cherev, and I will empty out the sword. In other words, you'll go through difficult times. You'll experience war. Vaitar tzachem shmama, your land will be desolate. Ve'arechem yucharba, your cities will become ruined. Az tirtze ha'aretz et shabtoteh. And then the land will finally, right, after all of this destruction, be appeased. That's one way of understanding it. For all of its shmitot, for all of its sabbatical years, right? Tirtze ha'aretz et shabtoteh, it's Shabbat, and what's the Shabbat of the land is Shemitah, is the sabbatical years. Kol yimei ha'shema, etc., etc., all the days of desolation. So Rashi here says an amazing thing. Rashi points out in verse 35, I think it is, hang on a second. Rashi begins to figure out, Shivim shana shel galut, there were 70 years of exile, shel galut bavel, of the Babylonian exile, that's in between the first and second temples, Zain. Hayu keneged shivim shnot ha-shmita v'yovel, shehayu bashanim shichius Yisrael be'artzam lifnei ha-makom. The 70 years of exile were directly parallel to the 70 sabbatical years that Israel did not keep, did not fulfill, that they angered God in their land for 430 years. Rashi, in other words, does a calculation that the reason that the exile was for 70 years was because of all the sabbatical years that the Jewish people didn't fulfill during the first temple period, which is not exactly a star period for our people. So that would seem to imply, according to the same Rashi, the same commentary, that the cause of exile is, excuse me, the sabbatical year. So which is it? Are we in exile because we didn't toil in Torah? Or are we in exile because we didn't fulfill the sabbatical years? And in both of these instances, as much as I think they're valuable mitzvot, these are the most important mitzvot. In other words, I can understand if it said you didn't fulfill shelo kiyemu Torah. They didn't fulfill Torah. But that's not what it says. It says that they didn't toil in Torah. Right? And never mind Shemitah, the sabbatical year. I would be willing to venture a safe bet that the majority of people on this call, in this class, have never really thought through the sabbatical year. And possibly may even never have experienced it. Certainly if you're not in Israel. So it can't be that essential a mitzvah to Judaism. So why is this the cause of exile? And which is it? Is it the study of Torah, or is it the sabbatical year? And by the way, if you want to complicate matters further, and there are other examples, but I'll just give you one. The Talmud, the Gemara, suggests even another reason. Now granted, this is agadic in nature. It's not necessarily to be taken literally, but it suggests a cause that's somewhat different, right? In Nedarim, the Talmud, the tractate of Nedarim, we're actually just starting in the Daf Yomi, in the regular daily Talmud folio, the section of the Talmud known as Nashim, literally women, in other words, all those areas that deal with our relationship with women, the laws of marriage, of Kedushin, the laws of Gittin, of divorce, the laws of Yevamot, of levirate marriages, and one of the tractates in this section, in this third section of the Talmud called Nashim, is Nedarim. And this deals with the vows that I make, that my spouse makes, how we relate to them, And in the Dari Mandav Pei Aleph, on the 80th verse folio, it says, quoting a verse, Vayomer Hashem al ozvam et Torati, the verse in Jeremiah says, why did God exile the Jewish people? Because they left my Torah. So what does this mean? Amar Rav Yehuda, Amar Rav, She'ein mevarchin b'Torah Tchila. That the Jewish people did not make the blessing over the study of Torah. Not even by the way that they didn't learn Torah. They learned Torah, they just didn't bless over the study of Torah. Now that's a fascinating thing. Right? Think about this for a minute. Okay? We've gone from sort of it being what I would have thought not fulfilling mitzvot, to maybe thinking it's because we don't keep the Torah, to realizing that it's because we don't toil in Torah study, to now saying it's not that we don't toil in Torah study. We not toil in Torah study. Right? We learn Torah. We just forget the blessing of the Torah. And Rashi, in his commentary on this tractate, says an amazing thing. Kishemashkinin the Talmud Torah. When people arise early to study Torah, which means they're toiling in Torah, v'talmidei chachamim, and they're Torah scholars, b'nei talmidei chachamim, and the sons of talmidei chachamim of Torah scholars, mitoch shehein zehirim la'asok b'Torah, because they are so careful to immerse themselves in Torah, v'regilin ba, and they become accustomed to it. Can you imagine what a level? You're accustomed to toiling in Torah, right? You go to Israel. You go to yeshiva, to a higher institute of Jewish study, you've become accustomed to spending your entire day studying Torah. You know, they tell about Rav Moshe Feinstein. Rav Moshe Feinstein was one of the great, great rabbis in the last generation. And he just so you understand the level of his scholarship, he was once asked a question. He was walking to a bus stop or something, and he was asked a question by someone, and he immediately off the top of his head began to rattle off all of these different commentaries, medieval commentaries and later commentaries, Rishonim, Achronim, the Rav Yos says this way, and the Mordechai says that way, and the Daniel Chamudot says this way, and you know, the Petri Tshuva says that way, and therefore this is what we should rule. So one of his students was in awe. He was just in awe. So he asked Rav Moshe Feinstein, after the person who asked the question sort of got his response and walked away, said, how does one achieve that? How do you know that so well, so balpeh, so by heart, so at the grasp? So Rav Moshe looked at him and he said, I don't understand. If you go through the code of Jewish law 400 times, then you'll know that. It's not so complicated, right? If you went through the code of Jewish law 400 times, you'd know it too. So I heard this story. First of all, it's irrelevant to me whether that's an accurate portrayal of the story, because they wouldn't tell stories like this about you and me. So if it didn't happen, it should have, right? But I want you to know, I'm still struggling to get through the whole code of Jewish law once. And Baruch Hashem, I've put a lot of time into it. 400 times. I mean, that's unbelievable. That's 4 or 5 times a year. So he did the same thing with the Talmud. And he would study reams of Talmud. And this is the way Torah scholars were. Right? I once heard from Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook. So this I believe to be accurate because I actually heard it from Rav Tzvi Yehuda, who was the son of Rav Cook. There was a period of 5.5 years when Rav Tzvi Yehuda, When Rav Cook was in, or it wasn't 5.5 years, whatever it was, 5 years. When Rav Avraham Yitzchak Cohen Cook, the first chief rabbi of Israel later, before it was a state, was learning in Valashin, in the yeshiva Valashin, and the Netziv, Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, the great Netziv, was the Rosh Yeshiva. And so Rav Tzvi Yehuda said of his father, that his father once mentioned the sconce, that during that period of time, he so missed that period of time, because during that period of time, he was able to study 60 pages, 60 dapim, 60 blot, 60 double-sided folios of Talmud a day. 60 pages a day. Do you understand this? Okay? I once sat down and figured this out. That's a 20-minute daf. Okay? I struggle with the daf yomi. If I can get through a double-sided page, and that's just the basic understanding, maybe with Rashi, in an hour and a half, he did it in 20 minutes, and I'm sure he did a lot more in his 20 minutes than I do in twice an hour and a half. Right? So Rav Moshe Feinstein was on that level. And he used to, all the time, when he would come into yeshiva, he would constantly be, you know, when you finish a tractate of Talmud, so you make a little celebration, you know, you gather people together, and you have a minyan, a quorum, and you say a special Kaddish, and it's a beautiful thing. And because he went through Shas on such a level on Talmud so often, so, you know, he was like making one of these every week. So if you make a party like that, if you're someone like me and you make a party, it's a big deal. You know, you bring a big spread and you, but for someone like Rav Moshe, like, you know, every other day he's making a, so he would bring like, you know, maybe a little schnapps, I don't know, a cup of orange juice, a little piece of sponge cake. But anyway, one day he gets to the Beis Medrash and he brings out a whole spread. He says he's making a tractate on the tractate of Nida. Now Nida happens to be the last section of the Talmud, the last tractate of the Talmud. So people figured this was special because, you know, it was the end of the entire Talmud. But it was unusual that he brought such a spread because he, you know, he went through Shas a few times a year. So somebody asked him, why is this so special that you brought so much food? He said, because this particular conclusion of the entire Talmud is the particular time that I study Talmud when I'm waiting for buses and elevators. Okay, in other words, every time he would be on the road and wait for a bus or an elevator, he had a tractate in his pocket, and he would learn that tractate. And that was separate from his other learning. He went through the entire Talmud in 15 minutes here, 20 minutes there. You know, just to show you what like, you know, we think we're clever because we have a BlackBerry and we do our email while we're waiting. He went through the Talmud, the entire Talmud. That's Amelim B'Torah. That's toiling in Torah. That's becoming accustomed to learning Torah to such a degree that you can't imagine standing at a bus stop with a minute to spare and not learning. So says Rashi, of such individuals, kishemashkin in Talmud Torah, they arise early for study of Torah, and they're Torah scholars. Mitoshein zirin lasok b'Torah, because they're so careful to study the Torah, v'regilin ba, and they're accustomed to it, einan zirin levarich, they're not careful to make the blessing over Torah, kishepotchin, when they start to study. They don't fulfill the blessing. Can you imagine? All of the exile, all of the pain, everything we've gone through for 2,000 years, because the Torah scholars are not blessing over the Torah. That's unbelievable. That's what all this is about. And of course, how do I reconcile these three different causes? So let me share with you an idea. I don't know that this idea is correct. Okay, this is just a possibility, an opinion, right? But there's one interesting detail. Usually when you have these types of questions, there's one detail on which everything is based. Okay? If you look in the Torah portion, when it talks about Shemitah, about the sabbatical year, it actually does not call it Shemitah. It doesn't call it the sabbatical year. Instead, it uses the more familiar term, Shabbat. Ki shavta haaretz. Literally, the land shabbated. Now, we take the word Shabbat to mean rest. But if you look carefully, you know, we've spoken before about the idea that numbers in Judaism are significant, and that if you find something repeated, you know, sort of 6 times, 7 times, 9 times, 10 times, so you will find at the beginning of the portion of Bahar that the word Shabbat is repeated 10 times. Ani noten lachem v'shavta haaretz, Shabbat l'Hashem, the land will rest a restful, I guess, year for Hashem. Uvashana ashvit, Shabbat Shabbaton. Shabbat. Again and again, the word Shabbat is used. Shabbat, Shabbaton, Shabtot Hashanim. Why is Shemitah here called Shabbat? Now, granted, the Shemitah year, the sabbatical year, is the Shabbat of the year. In other words, just like Shabbat is the seventh day, this is the Shabbat year, the seventh year. But there is a term for this, and that's Shemitah. So why is the word Shabbat used? So perhaps in order to understand this entire issue, We need to understand the meaning of Shabbat. This has to be connected to what Shabbat is all about. Now, we've spoken about this before, but and it's not a complicated idea. It's one of those ideas that's so obvious when you think about it. You wonder why more people don't get it. Shabbat's not a complicated idea. Abraham Joshua Heschel made it very simple. He wrote a magnificent book. If you've never read this book, I highly recommend it. It's called Shabbat, A Palace in Time, in which he describes that the goal of Shabbat, you know, most people think that Shabbat is about don't. Don't do this, don't do that. Don't get in the car. Don't turn on your radio. Don't use the internet. Don't use the laptop. You have to understand, all those items, they're just vehicles. They create the opportunity to experience what Shabbat really is. In fact, there are two parts to Shabbat. There are the mitzvot lo taseh, the prohibitions, and then there are the mitzvot taseh, the positive commandments, right? And even though you would think that if you don't do all the prohibitions, then you're ready to fill that vacuum with the positive, the Torah doesn't look at it that way. The Torah actually starts, if you look at the Ten Commandments, the second set of Ten Commandments, when they're repeated by Moshe in the book of Deuteronomy and Dvarim, it says, Shamor at Yom HaShabbat, guard, cherish Shabbat. And Jewish tradition teaches those are all the prohibitions. You know, don't use your BlackBerry. Don't use your laptop. Don't use your phone. Don't use your car. Turn off your television. Be in the moment. Focus on the day. Right? So remove those distractions because they're what prevent you from really experiencing Shabbat. But removing all those distractions isn't enough. That just creates the vacuum. If you don't fill it with something meaningful, then it really is just a day of don't. Right? And even if technically you will fulfill the mitzvah, right? You will fulfill Shabbat. You've missed the point of Shabbat. And that's why the first set of Ten Commandments in the book of Exodus is Zachor at Yom HaShabbat, remember Shabbat. And in fact, right, Chafetz Chaim in his introduction to his world-renowned set on Jewish tradition on Halacha, known as the Mishnah Berurah, points out that the mitzvah of Shabbat, right, is all about, I'm sorry, it's his introduction to the laws of Shabbat, points out that Zachor at Yom HaShabbat is the fulfillment of the positive commandments, right? And he describes the issue of oneg, of having pleasure on Shabbat. And in fact, the Talmud suggests that to fulfill the mitzvah of Shabbat, in fact, the Book of Knowledge, the Sefer HaChinuch, medieval work that we've mentioned before, which goes through the mitzvot, specifically calls the mitzvah of remembering Shabbat, the mitzvah lekadesh Shabbat bidvarim, to sanctify Shabbat with words. So how do we fulfill the mitzvah of remembering Shabbat? With Kiddush. We invest Shabbat with meaning. So what is Shabbat all about? Shabbat is all about, you know, people misunderstand the verse. Right? The verse says, Shesh Shemim Tavodu Vastekol Machtecha, 6 days you shall work and do all your labor. Uvayom Shvi Shabbat Vashem Elokecha, on the seventh day is for God. Lo Tasebo Kol Melacha, you're not supposed to do any labor. So most people think that that means that Shabbat, you can do everything you want during the week, but on Shabbat you shouldn't. But that's not at all what it means. We've mentioned this before. Maimonides points out 6 days a week Hashem gives us a world. And he wants us to be partners in creating that world. But on Shabbat, I'm supposed to step off the ride and try to imagine what all that work is for. What's it all about? What's the goal of it? Shabbat is all about learning to be in the moment instead of constantly running to the next moment. That is the essence of Shabbat. You know, I'll give you a great example. I remember when our daughter, our third child, was diagnosed with a brain tumor. And as some of you have heard the story, it's a longer story. You could imagine that that's a very tense experience. And, you know, Friday morning we all wake up to a normal life. By Friday at, midday, the world has turned completely upside down. And Dorit and I are driving with Adi down to a pediatric neurosurgeon who is waiting for us. I had an amazing angel named Glenn Morrison, Dr. Glenn Morrison. He's waiting for us in Miami Children's Hospital. And a couple hours later, he views Adi, and he looks at the MRI that she's taken, you know, that morning, and he says, yes, she has a lesion on her brain, she's going to need open brain surgery. That's a pretty intense experience, right? There are just no words to describe that. And, you know, you're there, and they're checking her out, and they want to see the MRIs, and you have to fulfill all this paperwork, and they have to talk to you. And by the time all this is, you know, getting close to Shabbat, so finally they finish with us. So I said to Dorit, you go ahead. Because we had gone to America for a couple of years. We were maybe a few months in America, and we were living in Boca, which is an hour north of Miami. It's Friday afternoon. It's getting close to Shabbat. So I said to Dorit, take a D, because the kids are, they don't know what's going on. And you head back up to Boca, and I'll wait for, we have to get the MRI back and fill out the paperwork, and I'll wait. So she went up with a D, and I'm waiting and waiting, and finally they give me this, whatever I need to go, and I get into the van, and I'm zooming out of the hospital, and I didn't really know my way around that well, so I hit I-95, and I didn't realize that I-95 on Friday afternoon is not an hour drive. So round about the area of North Miami, I realized there's just no way I'm making it home for Shabbat. And I didn't know what to do. And I thought, I was going to end up in Fort Lauderdale Airport. And a friend who at the time was Morty, who was the director at the time of Israelite, who had come all the way down to the hospital to bring us food for Shabbos, thinking we might get stuck there, himself trying to get back, had gotten stuck and realized that there was just no way he was going to make it home for Shabbat, detoured to a friend in Miami. Calls me up and says, I realize that you're leaving after me, because he knew already we were going to make it home. There's no way you're going to make it home for Shabbat. Where are you? So I told him where I was. I was stuck at 995. So he said, okay, get off the highway, and I'll tell you how to get to us, because otherwise you're not going to make Shabbos. And I pulled into, you know, into the driveway of some fellow that I'd never met, who was a friend of this friend, literally 6 minutes before Shabbos, like after candle lighting time already. And I was wearing a pair of jeans, because I had run out of the house, a pair of jeans, and a Lacoste shirt. And that's all I had for Shabbos. So I borrowed like a white shirt from this fellow, can you imagine? I mean, this is the Shabbat, we just found that our daughter has a brain tumor. And now I'm in Miami, and my wife's in Boca. And Shabbat comes in, and you're thinking to myself, like, this is where I want to be for Shabbat. I mean, no offense to the person who hosted me, an amazing fellow. But, so of course you take a pause, and you start to think about it. Obviously you need to be in this place for Shabbat. And obviously you need, if there was ever you needed a Shabbat to collect your thoughts, this was that Shabbat. And I actually, it's funny, because in retrospect, I ended up in a place where I really didn't know anybody. And I didn't have to give any of the classes they would normally have given. I wasn't even with my family. And as difficult as that was, I really had a chance to consider and to collect and to prepare and whatever else it might be. There's nothing. There's no phone. There's no BlackBerry. There's no laptop. There's nothing. There's just you and the opportunity to put it all in perspective. And although I have to be honest, when I entered that Shabbat, for the life of me, I couldn't understand what on earth I was doing there for Shabbat. By the time Shabbat was over, I understood that Shabbat is not about where you are, it's about who you are. You make a decision to let Shabbat come into your life. That's the message of Shabbat, bar none. And if that's the message of Shabbat, then Shemitah, when the Torah tells me here that Shemitah, the sabbatical year, is the Shabbat of the land, what it's trying to tell me, perhaps, is that Shemitah is for the nation what Shabbat is for the individual. By the way, that may be why Shemitah, the sabbatical year, is only in effect in Israel. Because you can't be a nation without a land, and therefore the only place where we're really a nation is in Israel. And I'll let you chew on that. And what's the purpose of Shemitah? What's the whole point of the sabbatical year? You know, in Israel, you start to appreciate this. I have a friend who lives in a religious kibbutz. And on the kibbutzim, so they're agricultural. So they have a rule in the religious kibbutz that anybody who wants to take the year off to study, the Shemitah year off to study, can do so. He just has to let them know in advance. So this guy, every seventh year, he puts down his plow, he hands in the keys to his tractor, he gives over whatever he gives over, and he goes to sit and learn. He goes to yeshiva. Takes a year off to recharge the battery. And that's really what the Jewish people are supposed to do. We're so involved. We're so immersed in building and creating and structuring that we've lost touch with what it's all about, what it's all for. Why do we build this state? Why are we building a home? What exactly is it all about? If you ask the average Israeli whether we need a Jewish state, and we've spoken about this before, I'm convinced most of them will say we do. But if you ask them why, most people have no idea. I did a little poll at the Israel Day Parade. Most people cannot answer the question, why do we need a Jewish state? Other than so that the Holocaust won't happen. So if you knew the Holocaust wouldn't happen, and there are plenty of American Jews who don't believe a Holocaust is in the making, then you don't really need a Jewish state. Why do we need a Jewish state? That's Shemitah. Shemitah gives me a chance to think about what is it I'm trying to build. Why do we need a Jewish people, and why do we need a Jewish state, and what does the Torah bring into the world, and how does the world become a better place? And by the way, what is the blessing over Brichat HaTorah, or over Torah study? A bracha, we've spoken about this also. A bracha, a blessing. Most people think that bracha means to say thank you. That you make a blessing to say thank you. But that's not entirely accurate. Because there is a word for blessing. And the word for blessing is for thank you. And the word for thank you is toda. Is thank you. That's not what we're saying. We're using the word baruch. So what does the word bracha mean? Levarech is to increase. Vashem berachat Avram bakol, Hashem blessed Avram with increased wealth, with increased progeny. What is it that I'm trying to increase when I make a blessing? I'm trying to increase Hashem's presence in my life. I take an apple, and instead of just eating it, I take a moment to appreciate that it's a gift from God. I transform it into an experience that allows me to connect with God in this world. Now you would think that if there's one experience that you couldn't help but experience God, it's through the study of Torah, but that's not true. Because Torah study, what is Torah? Torah is a recipe. It's a recipe that we're given by God, by Hashem, to make the world a better place. Now, if that Torah, that Torah study becomes the goal, we've missed the point. Because Torah study is a vehicle to investing a world with godliness. For bringing Hashem into the world, for making the world a better place. And it's so easy to become so immersed in the Torah study that I forget what the Torah study is all about. And that's exactly why we have a Shemitah year. We have a whole year where the Jewish people can let go of the plowing and the seeding and the harvesting. They can let go of the mundane and they can recall the Garden of Eden that we once experienced. The purpose of everything. They can reconnect with the Torah that we were given. And that is the point of Shemitah. And that may be, perhaps, one way to understand why all of this comes about, all these, this painful experience that we call the Tochacha, the Chukotai, the Klalot, the curses, simply because we weren't toiling in Torah, or because we weren't appreciating the sabbatical, or because we weren't blessing the Torah, because all those three items are connected as one and the same. If we do what we do, and we fulfill the letter of the law, but we lose the meaning and the spirit, then we've missed the boat. And don't get me wrong, because there's a whole generation of Jews that say, so let's forget the detail, and let's forget the letter of the law, and let's just immerse ourselves in the spirit. And that doesn't work either. And Jews today are finally realizing, you know, it's interesting, there are different movements in Judaism. And it's not for me, certainly over the phone, to judge. I'm not a judger by nature. But it's interesting that we can learn from everyone in this world. If Rav Kook learned something even from atheists, certainly we can learn from different Jews in different ways than people. And I've always felt that on a certain level, one of the things that we can learn from those Jews that are less immersed in ritual is how important it is to bring meaning into the ritual. And Jews who are more immersed in meaning can learn how valuable the ritual is. And if we could only meet in the middle. And that's the message of this week's portion. And when we start to lose the meaning, when we start to miss God in the equation, then it's only a matter of time before the whole thing goes to pot. And so Yehi Ratzon, God willing, that today, that we succeed in bringing meaning back into the mitzvot and back into life and back into Judaism, because that's ultimately what we're all searching for. But I wish you all a Shabbat Shalom. And, you know, next week is, God willing, Yom Yerushalayim, Jerusalem Day. And I believe, if I'm not mistaken, we'll be able to have a Tel HaTorah on Jerusalem Day, on the day when we celebrate the reunification of Yerushalayim and the return of the Jewish people to the Holy City, the Old City, and the Kotel. And maybe we have a chance to consider between now and then just how much meaning, you know, Yerushalayim needs to have. And maybe just one added addendum. Instead this year of celebrating the 48th year in Jerusalem by singing HaTikvah, maybe hearing Yerushalayim Shel Zahav on the radio, why don't you think about coming to Israel? If you've never spent a week studying with us in Israel, I urge you to think about it. It's the end of June, beginning of July. You can look it up on the web. It's an amazing experience. It's a chance to study in the old city of Yerushalayim with me and Rabbi Aaron. Rabbi Sam Shor will be there. The leadership training interns will be there. And as well as you know, touring, we'll go to Masada, and we'll go to the Golan Heights, and we'll go to Tzfat, and we'll walk around the old city. It's an amazing experience. So think about it, and if you're interested, you can always find us online. And in the meantime, I wish everybody a Shabbat Shalom, a happy Yom Yerushalayim. For those of you who have to leave, and for those of you who want to stay for a few, we have a few minutes for question and answer. I'm just going to unmute us. Hang on 1 second. Okay, so does anybody have a question out there?
We have the sabbatical year, which is, the prohibition to work on the land. Does that necessarily include that if you let the land lie fallow, how do we jump from there to a person going and learning in yeshiva? I mean, why couldn't the land could lie fallow and the person could go work somewhere else?
Well, remember that in the time of the Torah, it's a good question. There is, first of all, the letter of the law and the spirit of the law. It does not say that a person is obligated to go sit and study Torah. Okay? Doesn't say that in the verses, right? That's the commentary. The question is where that commentary comes from. So I will tell you two things. First of all, on a general, you know, sort of in a general area, in the time the Torah was written, life was an agricultural lifestyle. 90% of the workforce was agricultural, right? You didn't have department stores. People, you know, people bartered their own stuff, most jobs, right, investment banking really didn't exist for the most part, right? So that's first of all. So if you weren't working the land and you had all this free time, then the other question is what you would do with it. It was understood by Jewish tradition that the only reason not to be learning Torah was because you have a viable occupation that occupies your time. You have an obligation to support, you know, your family and the community, whatever it might be. But if the Torah is telling you this year you don't need to do that, then you'd have to have a good reason not to learn Torah, not to study. Right? So it's not as though you're transgressing anything by not doing it. It was a collective understanding that the Jewish people were being given this opportunity. Okay? It's like if Shabbat comes around. Like I remember we were in Boca, and we do this in Efrat now. We used to have a Kiddush year, okay? Every Shabbat morning after synagogue, when everybody else went off to stand around the Kiddush and kibbutz, we had a room and we would lay the Kiddush out on a table, and some of the people on this phone used to come, and we would sit around the table and we would learn while we had Kiddush, right? And I remember at the beginning, people would sometimes say, why do you think people would go to the Kiddush and learn? And my attitude was, no, you got it all wrong. You have to have a good reason not to be sitting and learning. Once you know you're going to Kiddush and you're in the synagogue building, assuming it's hopefully a good class, and you have an opportunity to stand in kibbutz or learn Torah, so how could you not learn Torah? You don't have a reason not to. And to their credit, that community really got it, because a lot of people would come to that class. Just because I think we that's, by the way, something to learn about our relationships and our children. We need to make available, right, study and opportunities to explore Jewish tradition on different levels, depending where we're at, in such a way that we'd have to have a good reason not to do it. Now, what we do is we create so many barriers, so many obstacles, so many different, you know, sort of avenues, that it's a much more difficult challenge to sit down and study Torah, right? Because you got to tell your kid, Baruch Hashem, I study with each of my children every week, some of them 3-4 times a week, right? And, you know, we create a window. So if I have to go and pull them off the laptop or from the TV or away from their ball playing or whatever it might be, that's a battle. So the first thing to do is to create that window. There's this time, that's my time. And they enjoy it. And I never pitched it to them as, come on, I want you to come study. It's, I want to spend time with you, and this is our time. Well, since we have this time, we're going to learn Torah. Right? So they're not missing something, they're filling something. And by the way, that's Shabbat. Some people, they struggle with this. They're like, oh, Shabbat is so tough. It's all day and I can't watch TV. If that's where your mind is at, of course Shabbat is tough. But if you can let go of all that and fill it up with something meaningful. You know, I was once talking to a fellow who was really trying to get into, you know, Talmud study, the Daf Yomi. And he was having a really hard time with it. He wasn't enjoying it. He didn't understand the Aramaic and, you know, the Schottenstein Talmud now, which makes everything easy, wasn't around. And I said to him, you know what? I would not be doing this right now. You're still at a stage where you need to first develop a habit of study that you really enjoy. And if it becomes such a toil, such a challenge, you know, it's like trying to run 10 miles before you're ready for it, you're not going to enjoy it, you're not going to end up sticking with it. You know, study Chumash, something you can really enjoy. When you develop the habit of study, this is your study time, then you can decide if you want to fill it with something else. You know, so it's the same thing with Shemitah. In other words, God is going to give us the vacuum. The Torah creates the vacuum. Now we have to decide how to fill it. You know?
And it's like, you're saying, like, the default position is learning Torah.
Right. Look, think about this. Most people take vacation. Most people in our strata, I'm not talking about, you know, the Chinese, you know, worker. But in our world, the people on this phone, most of us, we take vacation. And very often we take a couple weeks vacation in the summer. Okay. So in 1903, if you had a couple weeks vacation, to make a decision to go to Israel, that was a big decision. That's a tough decision. But today, how could it be that less than 14% of adults over the age of 30 in America have ever been to Israel? That's unbelievable to me. That's mind-boggling. How could it be, you know, we have a rabbinic enrichment fellowship. Every summer, we bring a special group of rabbis. They come to Israelite for a year, and they start a fellowship for a year. They come for a week to Israel in the summer. And one of the things when we conclude the program is, and some of you have rabbis in your community, you can talk to them about this, is that we feel, and we don't tell them to come to Israelite, but we tell them, it can't be that you're a rabbi, a Jewish rabbi today living in America, and that you don't make it your mission to be in Israel once a year. Now, if you can bring a group, great. If you can't bring a group, it can't be that a community has a rabbi that hasn't been to Israel in more than a year. It just can't be. And we started meeting rabbis. Why did we start talking about this? Because we've met rabbis who are young, they're modern Orthodox, or some of them went to YU, and they haven't been to Israel in 10 years. It's crazy. So first you have to create the box. The box is that people have time to take vacation. Now the question is how you fill it. You could get to Israel and spend a week in Israel for $1,000 if you really wanted to. Right? So there isn't anybody who can't do this. The question is how you do it. And by the way, this is not a pitch for Israelite summer program. I happen to think it's a great program. But it wouldn't matter to me if you came to Israel and you went to, I don't know, to work in a kibbutz. Just to ingest and invest yourself with Israel. You know, and for those of you that enjoy this type of study, can you imagine sitting around the table in the old city of Yerushalayim in a 900-year-old Crusader building, and we make a point of always coming up with new material every summer just for the two or three people who come back year after year, right? It just doesn't get better than that. You know, you finish a class, instead of having a Q&A over the phone, you come up on the roof, and we all get a cup of coffee, and we watch the sun set over Jerusalem, over the mountains, and we talk. What could be better? You know? But anyway, that's just my opinion. Anyway, we got to go. But I want to wish everybody a wonderful Shabbat. I can't tell you how much I appreciate you all calling in. And
thank you, Rav.
I would really love it if, you know, you all have my email. So if somebody does have a question, I usually get one or two. It's B-I-N-N-Y, Binny, at Israelite.org, I-S-R-A-L-I-G-H-T.org. And if you do click onto the online when we get it up, God willing, and it works for you, or it doesn't, you know, whatever your experience is, let us know so we can sort of see what we're doing and if it's working. All right, Shabbat Shalom, everybody. Thanks for calling in.
Thank you so much.
Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you so much.
Shabbat Shalom.
This presentation by Rabbi Binny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990, or in Jerusalem at country code 972-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.